Radio Derb here, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, John Derbyshire, with a roundup of the news this sad week. The New York Philharmonic Orchestra went off to play a concert in Pyongyang. Their program started with the national anthems of the United States and North Korea. Then they gave the Norks some Beethoven, the second piano concerto, and then, of course, the Fifth Symphony. They finished up with a Korean folk song beloved on both sides of the border, we're told, called Arirang, whose lyrics I think translate as something like, "We're all Koreans together, one heart and one soul, and the 55-year division of our country has all been a terrible misunderstanding, probably the fault of meddling foreigners." The musical director of the Philharmonic, brushing a tear from his eyes, declared that, actual quote, "There's no sides. There's no north and south in Arirang. It's a melody for everybody. All these artificially created barriers fade away." End of actual quote. Well, that's great. So I guess now that that silly artificial border zone has faded away, we can withdraw our 29,000 soldiers from South Korea. Right. Before the performance, the Philharmonic was given a big grand banquet. To make sure there was plenty of food for the banquet, 300 extra North Koreans starved to death. That's on top of the several thousand who starve to death in an average year anyway. Before leaving the Democratic People's Republic, each of the musicians received special gifts from the hands of the dear leader himself. Each musician got a box of the finest quality Korean ginseng, a bound multi-volume set of the collected works of Kim Il-sung, and a scale model of the USS Pueblo in 22-carat plutonium. Long live international harmony and cooperation! From August 1942 to July 1945, which is less than 3 years, please note, the notion of a nuclear weapon went from pure theoretical physics to the detonation of an actual atom bomb. That was the famous Manhattan Project, back when this was the can-do nation that actually, well, could do things. Now here we are, 63 years later, trying to secure our southern border. The Manhattan Project, it ain't. Here I was last week, reporting on our government's efforts. Quote from an Associated Press report on Friday. Quote, "Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff will today announce approval of a 28-mile section of virtual fence along Arizona's border with Mexico. The fence, to be built by the Boeing Corporation, and using technology that the Bush administration plans to extend to other areas of the Arizona border, could get underway as early as this summer," officials said. End quote. I was, of course, much too optimistic. Here's this week's news, quote from the Washington Post. "The Bush administration has scaled back plans to quickly build a virtual fence across the U.S.-Mexico border, delaying completion of the first phase of the project by at least 3 years, and shifting away from a network of tower-mounted sensors and surveillance gear. federal officials said yesterday. Technical problems discovered in a 28-mile pilot project south of Tucson prompted the change in plans. Department of Homeland Security officials and congressional auditors told a House subcommittee. End quote. So, this 28-mile stretch of our 2,000-mile border won't actually be secured until 2 years into the Al Gore administration, assuming that they continue with it. A 3-year delay. You see, that's just as long as it took to make the atom bomb. Of course, you have to make allowances. This is totally new and untried technology. Nobody ever secured a nation's border before. Putting up fences, building walls, this is the space age cutting edge of human technological achievement. Oh well, a 3-year delay for the 28-mile fence. At that rate, we should have the whole border secure in, just let me get my calculator here, oh, let me see, around about summer of the year 2222. Boy, when our federal government swings into action, things really get done, don't they? At last, at long last, someone asked Barack Obama about that wacky preacher who he claimed in his autobiography as his mentor and inspiration. That would be the guy who hero worships Louis Farrakhan, and whose website, once you get past the big Map of Africa logo, advertises his church as, quote, a congregation with a non-negotiable commitment to Africa. What about all that? Asked Tim Russert. Obama gave a very carefully lawyerish reply. Quote, I have been very clear in my denunciation of Minister Farrakhan's anti-Semitic comments. I think they are unacceptable and reprehensible. End quote. Well, that's nice. Now then, Senator, how about Farrakhan's... Oh, I'm sorry, I mean, of course, Minister Farrakhan's. How about his anti-white comments? Samples, just from doing a quick Google on Farrakhan quotes. Quote, murder and lying comes easy for white people. Or, quote, white people are potential humans. They haven't evolved yet. Did you denounce those, Senator? Are you going to? And don't you see how obnoxious this double standard is to a lot of us out here in voter land? Imagine that John McCain had given years of loyalty and gifts of money to a church that fronted its website with a big map of Europe and boasted of promoting a white value system. Imagine the pastor of that church had given an award with gushing praise to the leader of the Aryan nation. Imagine that John McCain explained himself by saying that, oh, he had denounced some anti-Muslim remarks by that leader, whom he referred to with a respectful honorific. Can you imagine any of that, Senator? No, I can't either. Senator, Louis Farrakhan doesn't look like a hero to very many Americans. To most of us, he looks like a racist thug. When you address him respectfully as Minister Farrakhan, you're insulting the people that Farrakhan insults, which is to say, white Americans, Jewish and Gentiles both. Don't you understand that? If you don't, then in my opinion, you have a problem. Meanwhile, Russia is having its own elections this Sunday. The ruling party, United Russia, has a presidential candidate, Mr. Dmitry Medvedev. Mr. Medvedev is a very close friend of current President Vladimir Putin. So close, in fact, that he has made it known that should he be elected president, he will make Mr. Putin his prime minister. But of course, you never know how elections will turn out. Plenty of other parties are running candidates. There's the Liberal Democratic Party, for example, headed by Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Oops, well, best forget about them. Well, then there's the good old Communist Party, headed by Gennady Zyuganov. No, I guess we can scrub them too. Or how about the Citizens' Force Party, which promotes liberty and private property? I like the sound of them. Are they in with a chance? Nope, I guess not. Looks like Mr. Medvedev's the favourite then, with Mr. Putin as favourite for the next Prime Minister. Of course, I'm just surmising here. We won't know for sure till the votes have all been collected and counted. I mean, I wouldn't want to, what's the expression? Jump the gun here, would I? The Declaration of Independence by the Albanians of Kosovo is having some interesting repercussions. People like the Bush administration and the big European countries, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, all recognised Kosovar independence in the belief that it was just the last phase in the breakup of the old Yugoslavia. Elsewhere in Europe, though, the suspicion is that this is not the end of something, but the beginning, or a continuation of something. Of what? Of a general splitting and dividing on ethnic lines that is going on all over the world, from Kosovo to Kenya, and not forgetting Iraq. Different ethnicities just don't want to share countries with each other anymore. Even dull old Belgium seems to be splitting, the French Belgians and the Flemish Belgians heading for divorce. You can see what's going on here if you look at the list of countries that are not happy about Kosovar independence. Spain is not happy. Why not? Well, they have Basque separatists. Romania's not happy. They have a big Hungarian minority. The Greek part of Cyprus is not happy. They still claim sovereignty over the Turkish part of Cyprus. Even China's not happy. If Kosovo can break away from Serbia, then why can't Taiwan or Tibet or eastern Turkestan break away from the People's Republic? Contrarywise, a lot of peoples that you never heard of, Ossetians, Transdniestrians, Abkhazians, a lot of these people are happy, because they'd like to break away from their parent countries too. Every ethnicity wants its own country nowadays. Well, personally, I'm fine with it. I just give thanks that I live in the good old USA, where these kinds of ethnic conflicts and separatist demands could never, never arise. Did you catch the Oscars this week? No, I didn't either. I had to defrag my hard drive that night. It's all gone political anyway. I mean, look at those top movies. No Country for 72-Year-Old Men. I mean, really. And then there was that other one. There Will Be Blood If You Don't Nominate Me. Who was promoting that? And then there was that movie based on some book by Charles Murray. The Diving Bell, Curve and Butterfly McQueen. For goodness sake, who wants to hear that divisive stuff? Let's heal. Let's unite. Let's have change. Let's, you know, have some healing, uniting, changefulness. That's what the country's looking for. Oh, and then there was that other movie, Atonement, which means making amends for something you did wrong. You know, like shredding your law firm's billing records or teaming up with the biggest liberal in the Senate to push open borders and amnesty legislation. Stuff like that. Stuff you really need to atone for. Politics, politics. You just can't get away from it. Who is the number one power in the world? Britain held that envied position for 100 years or so, down to the First World War, thanks to the fortifying powers of warm beer, Yorkshire pudding, and Marmite. Then the United States of America came up, and this country was top dog for a few decades. But who is top dog now? Answer, Iran. That's according to Little Squinty, the diminutive and hirsute president of Iran. Quote from the malevolent midget, quote, "Everybody has understood that Iran is the number one power in the world. Today, the name of Iran means a firm punch in the teeth of the powerful, and it puts them in their place." End quote. Well, that explains a lot. It explains those Iranian carrier groups patrolling the world's oceans. It explains those fleets of Iranian bombers that periodically darken our skies. It explains all the Made in Iran labels on everything we seem to buy nowadays. It explains the all-pervading influence of Iranian culture in our movies and popular music. Once upon a time there was Alexander, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, Napoleon. Now there's little what's-his-name, the poisoned dwarf of Tehran. Iran may only be ranked 17th by population, 24th by military expenditures, 38th by export volume, 79th by per capita GDP, 94th by Human Development Index, and 170th by fertility rate. But don't let mere statistics fool you. This is the world leader. You'd better send your kids off to learn Farsi if you want them to have any kind of future in the 21st century. That's all I have for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. A week that left us poorer than it found us. Whether the pen truly is mightier than the sword, I leave you to discuss among yourselves. But anyone who has served in the military is certainly entitled to a soldier's farewell. And anyone who, after serving, went on to fight with his pen for freedom so tirelessly for so long is entitled many times over.